Googling, and then she pointed out to Granny that it wasn't a very responsible analogy to divulge to a child. And then Granny groaned, "Oh, right, okay, let's say they don't drink it, it's just there, okay." So that's the whole story of the two golden knights who defeated the fears. Granny told it every time Elsa was afraid of anything, and even though Elsa was often quite right about her criticism of Granny's storytelling technique, it actually worked every time. She wasn't at all as afraid afterwards. The only thing the story never worked on was Granny's fear of death. And now it wasn't working on Elsa either, because not even fairy tales defeat shadows. "Are you scared?" asks Mum. "Yes," admits Elsa. Mum doesn't tell Elsa not to be afraid, and she doesn't try to trick her into believing that she shouldn't be. Elsa loves her for that. They're in the garage and have pushed the backrest down in Renault. The worst floats out over everything between them, and Mum unconcernedly scratches its pelt. She wasn't even angry when Elsa confessed that she'd been keeping it hidden in the storage unit, and she wasn't scared when Elsa introduced her. She just started stroking it behind its ear as if it was a kitten. Elsa reaches out and feels Mum's belly, and Halfy contentedly kicking in there. Halfy is not afraid either, because she is completely Mum and George, whereas Elsa is half her dad and Elsa's dad is afraid of everything, so Elsa gets afraid of about half of everything. Shadows, more than anything.
"Do you know who he was? The man who was chasing me?" she asks.
The worse buffets its head against hers. Mum gently caresses her cheek. "Yes, we know who he is."
"Who's we?"
Mum takes a deep breath. "Lennart and Maud and Alf and me." It sounds as if she's going to reel off more names, but she stops herself.
"Lennart and Maud?"
Elsa bursts out. Mum nods. "I'm afraid they know him best of all."
"So why did you never tell me about him then?"
Elsa demands. "I didn't want to scare you."
"That hardly worked, did it?"
Mum sighs, scratches the worse's pelt. The worse, in turn, licks Elsa's face. It still smells of sponge cake mix. Unfortunately, it's quite difficult to be angry when someone smelling of sponge cake mix is licking your face.
"It's a shadow,"
whispers Elsa. "I know," whispers Mum.
"Do you?"
"Your grandmother tried to tell me the stories, darling, about the land of almost awake and the shadows."
"And my Amis?"
asks Elsa. Mum shakes her head. "No, I know you had things there that she never showed me. And it was long ago. I was about as old as you are now. The land of almost awake was very small then. The kingdoms didn't have names yet." Elsa interrupts impatiently.
"I know, they got their names when Granny met Wolfart. She named them after things in his mother's language, and she took his own language and made it into the secret language so he'd teach her and she could talk to him. But why didn't she bring you with her in that case? Why didn't Granny show you the land of almost awake?"
Gently, Mum bites her lip. "She wanted to bring me, darling, many times, but I didn't want to go."
"Why not?"
"I was getting older, I was an angry teenager, and I didn't want my mother telling me fairy tales on the phone anymore. I wanted to have her here. I wanted her in reality." Elsa hardly ever hears her say, "my mother." She almost always says, "your grandmother." "I wasn't an easy child, darling. I argued a lot. I said no to everything. Your grandmother always called me the girl who said no." Elsa's eyes open wide. Mum sighs and smiles at the same time, as if one emotional expression is trying to swallow the other. "Well, I was probably many things in your grandmother's stories, both the girl and the queen, I think. In the end, I didn't know where the fantasy ended and reality began. Sometimes I don't even think your grandmother knew herself." Elsa lies in silence, staring up at the ceiling, with the worse breathing softly in her ear. She thinks about Wolfheart and the sea angel, living next door for so many years without anyone knowing the first thing about them, If holes were drilled in the walls and floors of the house, all the neighbours could reach out and touch one another. That was how close their lives were. And yet in the end they knew almost nothing about the others. And so the years just went by.
"Have you found the keys?"
asks Elsa, pointing at Renault's dashboard. Mum shakes her head. "I think your grandmother hid them, presumably just to tease Brit Marie. That must be why it's parked in Brit Marie's space."
"Does Brit Marie even have her own car?"
asks Elsa, because from where she's lying she can clearly see BMW, Kent's ridiculously oversized car. "No, but she had a car many years ago, a white one, and it's still her parking spot. I think it's about the principal. It's usually about the principal with Brit Marie," says Mum, with a smirk. Elsa doesn't quite know what that means. She doesn't know if it makes any difference either.
"How did Renault get here, then, if no one has the key for it?"
She thinks aloud, although she knows Mum won't be able to answer because she doesn't know either. So she asks Mum to tell her about the shadow. Mum brushes her hand over her cheek again and stands up laboriously from the seat with one hand over Harfy.
"I think Maud and Leonard will have to tell you about him, darling."
Elsa wants to protest, but Mum has already climbed out of Renault, so Elsa doesn't have much choice but to follow her. That is Mum's superpower, after all. Mum brings Wolfhart's coat. She says she's going to wash it, so he can have it when he comes home. Elsa likes thinking about that, how he's coming home. They put blankets over the worse in the back seat, and Mum calmly cautions it to stay still if it hears anyone coming, and it agrees. Elsa promises it several times that she'll find a better hiding place, although it can't seem to see the point of this. On the other hand, it looks very pleased about her going off to find more biscuits. Alf is standing guard at the bottom of the cellar stairs. "I made coffee," he mutters. Mum gratefully accepts a cup. Alf hands Elsa the other cup.
"I told you I don't drink coffee," says Elsa tiredly.
"It's not bloody coffee, it's one of those old boy drinking chocolate bastards," Alf answers indignantly.
Elsa peers into the cup, surprised.
"Where do you get this from?" she asks.
Mum never lets her have old boy at home because there's too much sugar in it.
"From home," mutters Alf.
"You have old boy at home?"
Elsa asks, sceptically.
"I can bloody go to the shop, can't I?" says Alf, sourly.
Elsa grins at him. She's thinking of calling Alf the Knight of Invective, because she's read about invective on Wikipedia, and she feels all in all there are too few knights of it. Then she takes a deep gulp and comes close to spitting it all out over Alf's leather jacket.
"How many spoonfuls of old boy did you put in this?"
"I don't know, 14 or 15, maybe," Alf mutters defensively.
"You're supposed to put in, like, 3?
Alf looks indignant, or at least Elsa thinks so. She put indignant in Dad's word jar one time, and she imagines that's what it looks like.
"It should bloody taste of something, shouldn't it?"
Elsa eats the rest with a spoon.
"So, you also know who was chasing me in the churchyard, don't you?"
she asks Alf, with half of the cup's contents in the corners of her mouth and on the tip of her nose.
"It's not you he's after."
Hello, he was chasing me."
Alf just slowly shakes his head.
"Yes, but you're not the one he's hunting."
Chapter 23. Dishcloth. Elsa has 1,000 questions about what Alf just said, but doesn't ask any of them because Mum is so tired once they've gone up into the flat that she and Harfy have to go straight to bed. Mum gets like that these days, tired as if someone pulled the plug. It's Harfy's fault, apparently. George says that to compensate for Harfy keeping them awake for the next 18 years, Harfy is making Mum fall asleep all the time for the first 9 months. Elsa sits on the edge of the bed, stroking her hair. Mum kisses her hands, whispering,
"It will get better, darling. It will be fine."
Like Granny used to say. And Elsa wants so, so much to believe that. Mum smiles sleepily.
Is Britt Marie still here?
She says, with a nod towards the door.
Britt Marie's nagging voice emanates from the kitchen, so the question immediately becomes rhetorical.
She is demanding a decision
from George on Renault, which is still parked in Britt Marie's slot in the garage.
We can't live without rules, George. Even Ulrika has to understand that.
George answers cheerfully that he can understand that well enough because George can understand everyone's point of view. It's one of the annoying things about him, and sure enough, seems to be getting Britt Marie into a huff. And then George offers her some eggs, which she ignores, insisting instead that all tenants submit to a full investigation regarding the pram, which is still locked up at the bottom of the stairs.
Don't worry, darling. We'll find a better hiding place for your friend tomorrow.
Mum mumbles half in her sleep and then adds with a smile,
Maybe we can hide it in the pram.
Elsa laughs, but only a little, and she thinks that the mystery of the locked pram is like the opening of an insanely awful Agatha Christie novel. Elsa knows that because almost all of Agatha Christie's novels can be read on the iPad, and Agatha Christie has never had such a stereotypical villain as Britt Marie. More likely she'd be a victim, because Elsa can imagine a murder mystery in which someone has bludgeoned Britt Marie to death with a candlestick in the library, and then everyone who knew her would be a suspect, because everyone would have a motive.
The hag was a nightmare!
And then Elsa feels a bit ashamed for thinking along these lines, but only a little.
Britt Marie doesn't mean any harm, she just needs to feel important,
Mum tries to explain.
She's still just a nagging old busybody, Elsa mutters.
Mum smiles. And then she gets comfortable on the pillows and Elsa helps her push one of them under her back and Mum strokes her cheek and whispers,
I want to hear the stories now, if that's all right. I want to hear the fairy tales from my Amos.
And then Elsa whispers calmly that Mum has to close her eyes, but only halfway. And then Mum does as she says, and Elsa has a thousand questions, but does not ask any of them. Instead, she talks about the cloud animals, and the enfants, and the regretters, and lions, and trolls, and knights, and the Nauween, and Wolfheart, and the snow angels, and the sea angel, and the dream hunters. And she starts talking about the princess of Miploris, and the two princelings who fought for her love, and the witch who stole the princess's treasure. But by then, Mum and Harfy are asleep. And Elsa still has a thousand questions, but does not ask any of them. She just covers Mum and Harfy with the blanket and kisses Mum on the cheek and forces herself to be brave, because she has to do what Granny made her promise to do, protect the castle, protect her family, protect her friends. Mum's hand fumbles for her as she's standing up, and just as Elsa is about to go, Mum whispers in a half-asleep state, All the photos on the ceiling in your grandmother's bedroom, darling. All the children in the photos. They were the ones who came to the funeral today. They're grown up now. They were allowed to grow up because your granny saved their lives. And then Mum is asleep again. Elsa is not entirely sure that she even woke up.
No shit, Sherlock,
whispers Elsa as she switches off the lamp. Because it wasn't so hard working out who the strangers were. It was forgiving them that was hard. Mum sleeps with a smile on her lips. Elsa carefully shuts the door. The flat smells of dishcloth, and George is collecting used coffee cups. The strangers were all here today drinking coffee after the funeral. They smiled empathically at Elsa, and Elsa hates them for it. Hates that they knew Granny before she did. She goes into Granny's flat and lies on Granny's bed. The streetlight outside plays against the photos on the ceiling, and as she watches, Elsa still doesn't know if she can forgive Granny for leaving Mum on her own so she could save other children. She doesn't know if Mum can forgive it either, even if she seems to be trying. She goes out of the door onto the stairwell, thinking to herself that she'll go back to the worse in the garage, but instead she sinks listlessly onto the floor, sits there forever, tries to think, but only finds emptiness and silence where usually there are thoughts. She can hear the footsteps coming from several floors down, soft, padding gently as if they're lost. Not at all the self-assured, energetic pacing the woman in the black skirt used to have when she was still smelling of mint and talking into a white cable. She wears jeans now, and no white cable. She stops about 10 steps below Elsa. "Hi," says the woman. She looks small. Sounds tired, but it's a different kind of tiredness than usual. A better tiredness this time. And she smells of neither mint nor wine, just shampoo. "Hello," says Elsa. "I went to the churchyard today," says the woman slowly. "You were at the funeral?" The woman shakes her head apologetically. "I wasn't there, sorry, I couldn't, but I..." She swallows the words, looks down at her hands. "I went to my boys' graves. I haven't been there in a very long time."
"Did it help?" asks Elsa.
The woman's lips disappear.
"I don't know."
Elsa nods. The lights in the stairwell go out. She waits for her eyes to grow accustomed to the darkness. Finally, the woman seems to gather all her strength into a smile, and the skin round her mouth doesn't crack quite as much anymore.
"How was the funeral?" she asks.
Elsa shrugs.
"Like a normal funeral? Far too many people."
"Sometimes it's hard to share one's sorrow with people one doesn't know, but I think..."
"There were many people who were very fond of your grandmother."
Elsa lets her hair fall over her face. The woman scratches her neck.
I understand. It's hard to know that your granny left home to help strangers somewhere else. Me, for instance."
Elsa looks slightly suspicious. It's as if the woman read her thoughts.
"It's known as the trolley problem. In ethics, I mean, for students at university, it's the discussion of whether it's morally right to sacrifice one person in order to save many others. You can probably read about it on Wikipedia."
Elsa doesn't respond. The woman seems to become ill at ease.
"You look angry."
Elsa shrugs and tries to decide what she's most angry about. There's a fairly long list.
"I'm not angry at you. I'm just angry at stupid Brit Marie," she decides to say in the end.
The woman looks slightly confused and glances down at what she's holding in her hands. Her fingers drum against it.
"Don't fight with monsters, for you can become one. If you look into the abyss for long enough, the abyss looks into you."
"What are you talking about?"
Elsa bursts out, secretly pleased that the woman speaks to her as if Elsa was not a child.
"Sorry, that was Nietzsche. He was a German philosopher. I'm probably misquoting him, but I think it could mean that if you hate the one who hates, you could risk becoming like the one you hate."
Elsa's shoulders shoot up to her ears.
"Granny always said, don't kick the shit, it'll go all over the place."
And that's the first time Elsa hears the woman in the black skirt, who now wears jeans, really burst out laughing. "Yes. Yes, that's probably a better way of putting it." She's beautiful when she laughs. It suits her. And then she takes 2 steps towards Elsa and reaches out as far as she can to give her the envelope that she's holding without having to move too close.
"This was on my boys. On their... It was on their headstone. I don't know who put it there. But your granny, maybe she figured out that I'd come."
Elsa takes the envelope. The woman in jeans has disappeared down the stairs before she has time to look up from the envelope. On it, it says, "To Elsa, give this to Leonard and Maud."
And that is how Elsa gets hold of Granny's third letter. Leonard is holding a coffee cup in his hand when he opens the door. Maud and Samantha are behind him, both looking very sweet. They smell of biscuits.
"I have a letter for you," Elsa declares.
Leonard takes it and is just about to say something, but Elsa goes on.
"It's from my granny. She's probably sending her regards and saying sorry because that's what she's doing in all the letters."
Leonard nods meekly. Maud nods even more meekly.
"We're so terribly sad about this whole thing with your grandmother, dear Elsa. But it was such a wonderfully beautiful funeral, we thought. We're so glad that we were invited. Come in and have a dream. And Alf brought over some of that chocolate drink as well."
Maud beams. Samantha barks. Even her bark sounds friendly. Elsa takes a dream from the proffered tin, filled to the top. She smiles cooperatively at Maud.
"I have a friend who likes dreams very much, and he's been on his own all day. Do you think it would be all right to bring him up?"
Maud and Leonard nod, as if it goes without saying. Chapter 24. Dreams. Maud doesn't look quite as convinced once the worse is sitting on her kitchen rug a few moments later, especially as it's literally sitting on the entire kitchen rug.
"I told you it likes dreams, didn't I?"
says Elsa cheerfully. Maud nods mutely. Leonard sits on the other side of the table, with an immeasurably terrified-looking Samantha on his lap. The worse eats dreams a dozen at a time.
"What breed is that?"
says Leonard very quietly to Elsa, as if he's afraid the worse might take offence.
"A worse," says Elsa with satisfaction.
Leonard nods like you do when you don't have a clue what something means. Maud opens a new tin of dreams and carefully pushes it across the floor with the tips of her toes. The worse empties it in three slavering bites, then lifts its head and peers at Maud with eyes as big as hubcaps. Maud takes down another two tins and tries not to look flattered. It doesn't go so very well. Elsa looks at the letter from Granny. It's lying unfolded and open on the table. Leonard and Maud must have read it while she was in the cellar getting the worse. Leonard notices her looking, and he puts his hand on her shoulder.
"You're right, Elsa. Your grandmother says sorry." "For what?"
Maud gives the worse some cinnamon buns and half a length of sweet cake.
"Well, it was quite a list. Your grandmother was certainly different,"
Elsa interjects. Maud laughs warmly and pats the worse on the head. Leonard nods at the letter.
"First of all, she apologizes for telling us off so often, and for being angry so often, and for arguing and causing problems. It's really nothing to apologize about. All people do that from time to time," he says, as if apologizing for Granny apologizing.
"You don't,"
thinks Elsa, and likes them for it. Maud starts giggling.
"And then she apologized about that time she happened to shoot Leonard from her balcony with one of those, what are they called, paint bomb guns?"
Suddenly she looks embarrassed.
"Is that what it's called, paint bomb?"
Elsa nods, even though it isn't. Maud looks proud.
"Once, your grandmother even got Brit Marie. There was a big pink stain on her floral print jacket. And that's Brit Marie's favourite jacket, and the stain wouldn't even go away with Vanish. Can you imagine?"
Maud titters, and then she looks very guilty.
"What else does Granny apologise about?"
Elsa asks, hoping for more stories about someone shooting that paintball gun at Brit Marie. But Leonard's chin drops towards his chest. He looks at Maud and she nods, and Leonard turns to Elsa and says,
"Your granny wrote that she was sorry for asking us to tell you the whole story. Everything you have to know."
"What story?"
Elsa's about to ask, but she suddenly becomes aware of someone standing behind her. She twists round in her chair, and the boy with a syndrome is standing in the bedroom doorway with a cuddly lion in his arms. He looks at Elsa, but when she looks back at him, he lets his hair fall over his brow, like Elsa sometimes does. He's about a year younger,
but almost exactly as tall, and they have the same hairstyle and almost the same colour too. The only thing that sets them apart is that Elsa is different, and the boy has a syndrome, which is a very special kind of difference. The boy doesn't say anything, because he never does. Maud kisses his forehead and whispers, "Nightmare," and the boy nods. Maud gets a big glass of milk and a whole tin of dreams, takes his hand and leads him back into the bedroom, while robustly saying, "Come on, let's chase them away at once." Lennart turns to Elsa. "I think your grandmother wanted me to start at the beginning." And that was the day Elsa heard the story of the boy with a syndrome, a fairy tale she'd never heard before, a tale so terrible it makes you want to hug yourself as hard as you can. Lennart tells her about the boy's father, who has more hatred in him than anyone could think would be possible to fit into one person. The father used narcotics. Lennart stops himself and seems worried about frightening Elsa, but she straightens her back and buries her hands in the worser's fur and says, "It doesn't matter." Lennart asks if she knows what narcotics are, and she says she's read about them on Wikipedia. Lennart describes how the father became a different creature when he used drugs, how he became dark in his soul, how he hit the boy's mother while she was pregnant because he didn't want to become anyone's father. Lennart's eyes start blinking more and more slowly, and he says that maybe it was because the father feared the child would be as he was, filled with hatred and violence. So when the boy was born, and the doctors said he had a syndrome, the father was beside himself with rage. He couldn't tolerate that the child was different. Maybe it was because he hated everything that was different. Maybe because when he looked at the boy, he saw everything that was different in himself. So he drank alcohol, took more of that stuff on Wikipedia, and disappeared for entire nights, and sometimes for weeks on end, without anyone knowing where he was. Sometimes he came home utterly calm and withdrawn. Sometimes he cried, explaining that he'd had to keep out of the way until he'd wrung his own anger out of himself. As if there was something dark, living in him, that was trying to transform him, and he was struggling against. He could remain calm for weeks after that, or months. Then one night, the dark took possession of him. He hit, and hit, and hit them, until neither of them were moving anymore. And then he ran. Maud's voice moves gently through the silence that Lennart leaves behind him in the kitchen. In the bedroom, the boy with the syndrome snores, which is one of the first sounds Elsa has ever heard him make. Maud's fingertips scramble about among the empty biscuit tins on the kitchen top. "We found them. We'd been trying for such a long time to make her take the boy and leave, but she was so afraid. We were all so afraid. He was a terribly dangerous man," she whispers. Elsa grips the worst tighter.
"Then what did you do?"
Maud crumples up by the kitchen table. She has an envelope in her hand, the same as the one Elsa arrived with.
"We knew your grandmother from the hospital. We ran a cafe back then, you see, for the doctors. And your grandmother came there every day. A dozen dreams and a dozen cinnamon buns every single day. I don't know how it started, really, but your grandmother was the sort of person one told things to, if you see what I mean. I didn't know what to do about Sam. I didn't know who to turn to. We were so terribly frightened, all of us. But I called her. She arrived in her rusty old car in the middle of the night.
'Renault!'
Elsa exclaims, because for some reason she has a sense that he deserves his name in the fairy tale if he's the one who came to their rescue. Lennart clears his throat with a sad smile. "Her Renault, yes. We took the boy and his mother with us, and your grandmother drove here. Gave us the keys to the flats. I can't think how she got her hands on them, but she said she'd clear it with the owners of the building. We've been living here ever since."
"And the father, what happened when he realized everyone was gone?"
Elsa wants to know, although she actually doesn't want to know. Lennart's hand seeks Maud's fingers.
"We don't know. But your grandmother came here with Alf and said, 'This is Alf, and he's going to fetch all the boys' things,
and she went back there with Alf, and the boy's father turned up, and he was... nothing but darkness then, darkness from deep inside. He hit Alf something terrible.
Leonard stops himself the way one does when suddenly reminding oneself that one is talking to a child. Fast forwards through the story.
Well, of course, he was already gone by the time the police came, and Alf, gosh, I don't know, he was patched up at the hospital and drove home by himself and never said a word about it again. And 2 days later, he was driving his cab again. He's made of steel, that man.
And the father,
Elsa persists. He disappeared. Disappeared for years. We thought he'd never give up trying to find us, but he was gone for so long that we hoped, says Leonard, interrupting himself as if the words are too heavy for his tongue.
But now he's found us,
Maud fills in.
How?
Asks Elsa. Leonard's eyes creep along the tabletop.
Alf thinks he found your grandmother's death notice, you see, and using that he found the undertaker's, and there he found...
He starts to say, then looks as if he's reminding himself of something once again.
Me?
Elsa gulps. Leonard nods, and Maud lets go of his hand and runs round the table and embraces Elsa.
Dear, dear Elsa, you have to understand, he hasn't seen the boy in many years. And you're about the same size, and you have the same hair. He thinks you're our grandchild.
Elsa closes her eyes. Her temples are burning, and for the first time in her life, she uses pure and furious willpower to go to the land of almost awake, without even being close to sleeping. With all the most powerful force of imagination she can muster, she calls up the cloud animals and flies to Meodacus, gathers up all the courage she can carry. Then she prizes her eyes open and looks at Leonard and Maud and says,
"So you're his mother's parents?"
Leonard's tears fall onto the tablecloth like rain against a windowsill.
"No. We're his father's parents."
Elsa squints.
"You're the father's parents."
Maud's chest rises and sinks, and she pats the worse on the head and goes to fetch a chocolate cake. Samantha looks cautiously at the worse. Leonard goes to get more coffee. His cup trembles so much that it spills onto the bench.
"I know it sounds terrible, Elsa, taking a child from his father to do that to your own son, but when you become grandparents, then you are grandparents first and foremost," he whispers sadly.
"You're a grandmother and a grandfather. Above all things, always, always," Maud adds with unshakable defiance, and her eyes burn in a way that Elsa wouldn't have believed was possible in Maud. Then she gives Elsa the envelope she got from the bedroom. It has Granny's handwriting on it. Elsa doesn't recognize the name, but she understands it's for the boy's mother.
"She changed her name when we moved here," Maud explains, and in the softest voice possible adds, "Your grandmother left this letter with us months ago. She said you had to come for it. She knew you'd come."
Leonard inhales unhappily. His and Maud's eyes meet again. Then he explains, "But I'm afraid that first of all we have to tell you about our son, Elsa. We have to tell you about Sam, and that's one of the things your grandmother apologizes for in her letter. She writes that she's sorry she saved Sam's life." Maud's voice cracks until her words are like little whistles.
"And then she wrote that she was sorry for writing to say she was sorry about it, sorry for regretting that she had saved our son's life, sorry because she no longer knew if he deserved to live, even though she was a doctor."
Night comes to the streets outside the window. The kitchen smells of coffee and chocolate cake, and Elsa listens to the story of Sam, the son of the world's kindest couple, yet who became more evil than anyone could understand, who became the father of the boy with the syndrome, who in turn had less evil in him than anyone could have believed, as if his father took it all on his shoulders and passed none of it on.
She heard the story of how Sam was once a little boy himself, and how Maud and Leonard, who had waited for a child for so long, and who had loved him as parents love their children, and like all parents, even the very, very worst possible, must at some point have loved their children. That is how Maud puts it. Because otherwise one can't be a human being. I just can't imagine one could be a human otherwise, she whispers. And she insists that it has to be her fault, because she can't imagine that any child is born evil. It has to be the mother's fault if a boy, who was once so small and helpless, grows up into something so terrible. She's quite sure of that. In spite of Elsa saying that Granny always said some people are actually just shits and that it's no one else's fault than the shit. But Sam was always so angry. I don't know where all that anger came from. There must have been a darkness in me that I passed over to him, and I don't know where it came from, Maud whispers, quite crushed. And then she talks about a boy who grew up and always fought, always tormented other children at school, always chased those who were different. And about how when he was an adult, he became a soldier and went to far-off lands because he thirsted for war. And how he met a friend there, his first real friend. About how everyone who saw it said that it had changed him, brought out something good in him. His friend was also a soldier, but another sort of soldier without that thirst. They became inseparable. Sam said his friend was the bravest warrior he had ever seen. They went home together and his friend introduced Sam to a girl he knew, and she saw something in Sam, and for a brief moment, Leonard and Maud also got to see a glimpse of someone else, a Sam beyond the darkness. We thought she'd save him. We all hoped so much that she'd save him because it would have been like a fairy tale. And when one has lived in the dark for so long, it's so very difficult not to believe in fairy tales, Maud admits while Leonard clasps her hand. But then those little circumstances of life came up, Leonard sighs, like in so many fairy tales. And maybe it wasn't Sam's fault, or maybe it was entirely Sam's fault. Maybe it's for people much wiser than I to decide whether every person is completely responsible for their actions or not. But Sam went back to the wars, and he came home even darker. He used to be an idealist, Maud interjects gloomily. Despite all that hatred and anger, he was an idealist. That's why he wanted to be a soldier. And then Elsa asks if she can borrow Maud and Leonard's computer.
If you have a computer, I mean,
she adds apologetically, because she thinks about the palaver she had with Wolfart when she asked him the same thing. Of course we have a computer, says Leonard, puzzled. Who doesn't these days? Quite right, thinks Elsa, and decides to bring it up with Wolfart next time he turns up, if there is another time. Leonard leads her past the bedroom. In the little study at the far end of the flat, he explains that their computer is very old, of course, so she has to have a bit of patience. And on a table, in there, is the most unwieldy computer Elsa has ever seen. And at the back of the actual computer is a gigantic box, and on the floor is another box.
What's that?
Says Elsa, pointing at the box on the floor. That's the actual computer, says Leonard.
And what about that?
Asks Elsa, and points at the other box.
That's the monitor, says Leonard,
and presses a big button on the box on the floor, then adds, it'll take a minute or so before it starts, so we'll have to wait a bit.
A minute?
Elsa bursts out, and mumbles,
wow, it really is old.
But when the old computer has eventually got started, and Leonard, after many ifs and buts, has got her onto the internet, and she's found what she's looking for, she goes back into the kitchen and sits opposite Maud.
So, it means a dreamer. An idealist, I mean. It means a dreamer.
Yes, yes, you could probably say that, says Maud with a friendly smile.
It's not that you could say it, it's what it actually means, Elsa corrects.
And then Maud nods, even friendlier. And then she tells the story of the idealist who turned into a cynic And Elsa knows what it means because a teacher at Elsa's preschool once called Elsa that. There was an uproar when Elsa's mum found out about it, but the teacher stood his ground. Elsa can't remember the exact details, but she thinks it was that time she told the other preschool pupils how sausages were made. She wonders if she's thinking about these things as a kind of defense mechanism, for this tale really has too much reality in it. It often happens when you're almost eight that there's just too much reality. Maud describes how Sam went off to a new war. He had his friend with him, and for several weeks they had been protecting a village from attack by people who, for some reason unknown to Maud, wanted to kill all who lived there. In the end, they received an order to abandon the place, but Sam's friend refused. He convinced Sam and the rest of the soldiers to stay until the village was safe and took as many injured children as they could fit into their cars to the nearest hospital, many miles away, because Sam's friend knew a woman who worked as a doctor there, and everyone said she was the most skillful surgeon in the whole world. They were on their way through the desert when they hit the mine. The explosion was merciless. There was a rain of fire and blood.
"Did anyone die?"
asks Elsa, without really wanting to know the answer. "All of them," says Leonard, without wanting to speak the words out loud. "Except Sam's friend, and Sam himself." Sam was unconscious, but his friend dragged him out of the fire. Sam was the only one he had time to save. The friend had shrapnel in his face and terrible burns, but when he heard the shots and realized they'd been ambushed, he grabbed his rifle and ran into the desert and didn't stop firing until only he and Sam lay there in the desert, panting and bleeding. The people who had been shooting at him were boys. Children. Just like the children the soldiers had just tried to save. Sam's friend could see that as he stood over their dead bodies with their blood on his hands. And he was never the same again. Somehow he managed to carry Sam through the desert and didn't stop until he came to the hospital and Elsa's grandmother came running towards them. She saved Sam's life. He would always have a slight limp in one leg, but he would survive. And it was at that hospital that Sam started smoking Granny's brand of cigarettes. Granny also apologizes about that in the letter. Maud carefully places the photo album in front of Elsa, as if it was a small creature with feelings. Points at a photo of the boy with the syndrome's mother. She's standing between Leonard and Maud, and wearing a bridal gown, and they're laughing, all three of them. I think Sam's friend was in love with her. But he introduced her to Sam, and they fell in love instead. I don't think Sam's friend ever said anything. They were like brothers, those two, can you imagine? I think his friend was just too kind to mention his own feelings. Do you understand? Elsa understands. Maud smiles. He was always such a soft boy. Sam's friend. I always thought he had the soul of a poet. They were so different, him and Sam. It's so terribly difficult to imagine he would do all that he did to save Sam's life. That the place they were in could have made him such a fearsome... She's silent for a long time, overcome with sorrow.
Warrior,
she whispers, turning the pages of the photo album. Elsa doesn't need to see the photo to know who it's of. It's Sam. He's standing somewhere in a desert, wearing a uniform and supporting himself on crutches. Next to him stands Elsa's granny with a stethoscope round her neck. And between them stands Sam's best friend, Wolfheart. Chapter 25. Spruce. It was the cloud animals that saved the Chosen One when the Shadows came in secret to the Kingdom of Mimovas to kidnap him. For while Miamis is made of fantasy, Mimovas is made of love. Without love there is no music, and without music there is no Mimovas, and the Chosen One was the most beloved in the whole kingdom. So if the Shadows had taken him, it would eventually have led to the downfall of the Land of Almost Awake. If Mimovas falls, then Miravas falls, and if Miravas falls, then Miamis falls, and if Miamis falls, then Miodacus falls,
And if Meodacus falls, then Miploris falls. Because without music, there can't be any dreams. And without dreams, there can't be any fairy tales. And without fairy tales, there can't be any courage. And without courage, no one would be able to bear any sorrows. And without music and dreams and fairy tales and courage and sorrow, there would only be one kingdom left in the land of almost awake. Mibatalos. But Mibatalos can't live alone, because the warriors there would be worthless without the other kingdoms, because they'd no longer have anything to fight for. Granny also stole that from Harry Potter, that bit about having something to fight for. But Elsa forgave her because it was quite good. You're allowed to nick stuff if it's good. And it was the cloud animals that saw the shadows stealing along between the houses in Mimovis, and they did what cloud animals do. They swept down like arrows and up again like mighty ships. They transformed themselves into dromedaries and apples and old fishermen with cigars, and the shadows threw themselves into the trap. Because soon they didn't know who or what they were chasing. Then all at once the cloud animals disappeared, and one of them bore away the chosen one, all the way to Miamis. And that was how the war without end began. And if it hadn't been for the cloud animals, it would have ended there that day, and the shadows would have won. Elsa is in the land of almost awake all night. She can get there whenever she wants now, as if it had never been a problem. She doesn't know why, but assumes it's because she has nothing to lose anymore. The shadow is in the real world now. Elsa knows who he is, and she knows who Granny was and who Wolfheart is and how it all hangs together. She's not frightened anymore. She knows that the war will come, that it's inevitable, and the mere fact of knowing it makes her strangely calm. The land of Almost Awake is not burning as it was in the dream. Wherever she rides, it's as beautiful and tranquil as ever. Only when she wakes up does she realize that she has avoided venturing into Miamis. She rides to all five other kingdoms, even the ruins where Mibatalos used to be before the war without end, but never to Miamis. Because she doesn't want to know if Granny is there. Doesn't want to know if Granny isn't there. Dad is standing in the doorway of her bedroom. At once she's wide awake, as if someone just squirted menthol up her nose, which, just as an aside, works insanely well if you want to wake someone up. You'd know that if you have the kind of granny Elsa had.
What's the matter? Is Mum ill? Is it a halfie?
Dad looks dubious and slightly nonplussed. Elsa blinks away her sleep and remembers that Mum is at a meeting at the hospital because she tried to wake Elsa up before she left, but she pretended to be asleep. And George is in the kitchen, because he came in a bit earlier to ask if she wanted any eggs, but she pretended to be asleep. So she looks at her father with confusion.
It's not your day for you to be with me, is it?
Dad clears his throat. Looks like dads do when it suddenly dawns on them that something they used to do because it was important to their daughters has now become one of those things their daughters do because it's important to their dads. It's a very thin line to cross. Neither dads nor their daughters ever forget when they do cross it. Elsa counts the days in her head, instantly remembers and instantly apologizes. She was right, it isn't Dad's day, but she was wrong because today's the day before Christmas, which is a terrible thing to forget, because the day before Christmas is her and Dad's day. Christmas Tree Day! As the name subtly suggests, this is the day that Elsa and Dad buy their Christmas tree. A plastic one, obviously, because Elsa refuses to buy a real tree. But because Dad enjoys the annual tradition so much, Elsa insists on buying a new plastic tree every year. Some people find it a bit of an odd tradition, but Granny used to say that every child of divorce has the right to get a bit bloody eccentric now and then. Mum, of course, was very angry at Granny about the whole plastic tree thing, because she likes the smell of a real spruce tree, and always said that the plastic tree was something Granny had duped Elsa about. Because it was Granny who had told Elsa about the Christmas tree dance in Miamis, and no one who's heard that story wants to have a spruce tree that someone has amputated and sold into slavery. In Miamis, spruce trees are living, thinking creatures with, considering that they're coniferous trees, an unaccountably strong interest in home design. They don't live in the forest, but in the southern districts of Miamis, which have become quite trendy in recent years, and they often work in the advertising industry and wear scarves indoors. And once every year, soon after the first snow has fallen, all the spruce trees gather in the big square below the castle and compete for the right to stay in someone's house over Christmas. The spruce trees choose the houses, not the other way round, and the choice is decided by a dance competition. In the olden days, they used to have duels about it, but spruce trees are generally such bad shots that it used to take forever. So now they do spruce dancing, which looks a bit unusual because spruce trees don't have feet. And if a non-spruce tree wants to imitate a dancing spruce tree, they just jump up and down. It's quite handy, particularly on a crowded dance floor. Elsa knows that because when Dad drinks a glass and a half of champagne on New Year's Eve, he sometimes does the spruce dance in the kitchen with Lisette. But for Dad, it's just known as dancing.
"Sorry, Dad, I do know what day it is,"
Elsa yells, hopping into her jeans, getting into her jumper and jacket and running into the hall.
"I just have to do one thing first."
Elsa hid the worst in Renault last night. She brought it down a bucket of cinnamon buns from Maud and told it to hide under the blankets in the back seat if anyone came down into the garage.
"You have to pretend you're a pile of clothes or a TV or something," suggested Elsa,
though the words didn't look entirely convinced. So Elsa had to go and get a sack of dreams from Maud, after which the worst gave in and crept under the blankets. It didn't look much like a TV, though. Elsa said goodnight, sneaked back up the stairs and stood in the dark outside the flat, where the mother and the boy with the syndrome lived. She was going to ring the doorbell, but she couldn't quite make herself do it. Didn't want to hear any more stories. Didn't want to know about shadows and darkness. So she just put the letter in the slot in the door and ran away. Their door is locked and shut today. All the other doors, too. Anyone who's awake has left the house. Everyone else is still asleep. So Elsa hears Kent's voice several floors up, even though he's whispering, because that's how the acoustics of stairwells work. Elsa knows that because acoustics is a word for the word jar. She hears Kent whispering,
"Yes, I promise I'll be back tonight."
But when she comes down the last flight of stairs, past the Wirth and Wolfhart's flats, and the boy and the mother's flat, Kent suddenly starts talking in a loud voice and calling out,
"Yes, Klaus, in Frankfurt, yes, yes, yes."
And then he turns round and pretends that he's only just noticed Elsa standing behind him.
"What are you doing?" asks Elsa suspiciously.
Kent asks Klaus to hold the line, as you do when there is actually no Klaus at all on the line. He's wearing a rugby shirt with numbers and a little man on a horse on his chest. Kent has told Elsa that this sort of shirt costs more than 1,000 crowns, and Granny always used to say that those sorts of shirts were a good thing, because the horse functioned as a sort of manufacturer's warning that the shirt was highly likely to be transporting a muppet.
"What do you want?" sneers Kent.
Elsa stares at him, then at the small red bowls of meat that he's distributing down the stairwell.
"What are those?"
Kent throws out his hands so quickly that he almost throws Klaus into the wall.
"That hound is still running around here. It reduces the value of the leasehold conversion."
Elsa backs away watchfully, without taking her eyes off the bowls of meat. Kent seems to realize that he has expressed himself a little clumsily, so he makes another attempt, in the sort of voice that men of Kent's age think one must put on when talking to girls of Elsa's age, so they'll understand.
"Brit Marie found dog hairs on the stairs, you understand, darling? We can't have wild animals roving round the building. It reduces the value of the leasehold conversion. You see?"
He smiles condescendingly. She can see that he's glancing insecurely at his telephone.
"It's not like we're going to kill it. It'll just go to sleep for a bit, okay? Now, why don't you be a good girl and go home to your mummy?"
Elsa doesn't feel so very good, and she doesn't like the way Kent makes quotation marks in the air when he says, "Go to sleep."
"Who are you talking to on the phone?"
"Klaus, a business contact from Germany,"
answers Kent, as one does when doing no such thing.
Sure,
says Elsa. Kent's eyebrows sink.
Are you giving me attitude?
Elsa shrugs.
I think you should run home to your mummy now,
Kent repeats a touch more menacingly. Elsa points at the bowls.
Is there poison in them?
Listen, girlie, stray dogs are vermin. We can't have vermin running about here, and rust heaps down in the garage and all kinds of crap. It'll lower the value, don't you understand? It's better for everyone this way.
But Elsa hears something ominous in his voice when he says, rust heaps. So she pushes past him and charges down the cellar stairs, throws open the door to the garage and stands there with her hands shaking and her heartbeat thumping through her body. She knocks her knees against every step on the way back up.
Where's Reno? What the hell have you done with Reno?
She yells at Kent. She waves her fists at him, but only manages to grab hold of Klaus, so she throws Klaus down the cellar stairs so the glass display and plastic cover are smashed and tumble down in a miniature electronic avalanche towards the storage units.
Are you out of your bloody mind, you stupid kid? You know what that telephone cost?
Yells Kent. And then he tells her it bloody cost 8,000 crowns. Elsa informs him that she couldn't give a damn what it cost. And then Kent informs her with a sadistic gleam in his eye exactly what he did with Reno. She runs up the stairs to fetch Dad, but stops abruptly on the penultimate floor. Britt Marie is standing in her doorway. She's clasping her hands over her stomach, and Elsa can see that she's sweating. The kitchen behind her smells of Christmas food, and she's wearing her flower print jacket with her large brooch. The pink paintball stain is hardly visible at all.
You mustn't let Kent kill it, pleads Elsa, wide-eyed. Please, Britt Marie, it's my friend.
Britt Marie meets her eyes, and for a single fleeting second there's some humanity in them. Elsa can see that. But then Kent's voice can be heard, calling to Britt Marie from the stairwell that she has to bring more poison. And then the normal Britt Marie is back.
Kent's children are coming here tomorrow. They're afraid of dogs, she explains firmly. She straightens out a wrinkle that isn't there on her skirt and brushes something invisible off her floral print jacket.
We're having a traditional Christmas dinner here tomorrow with some normal Christmas food like a civilized family. We're not barbarians, you know.
Then she slams the door. Elsa stays where she is and realizes that Dad is not going to be able to solve this because tentativeness is not a very useful superpower in this type of emergency situation. She needs reinforcements. She's been banging on the door for more than a minute before she hears Alf's dragging footsteps. He opens it with a cup of coffee in his hand that smells so strong that she's sure a spoon would get stuck in it.
I'm asleep, he grunts.
He's killing Reno, sobs Elsa.
Killing? Nothing's gonna be killed round here. It's only a bloody car, says Alf,
swallows a mouthful of coffee and yawns.
It's not just a car. It's Reno.
Who the hell has told you he's gonna kill Reno?
Kent.
Elsa hasn't even had time to explain what's in Reno's back seat before Alf has put down the coffee cup, stepped into his shoes and set off down the stairs. She hears Alf and Kent roaring at each other so terribly that she has to cover her ears. She can't hear what they're saying, except that it's a lot of swear words, and Kent shouts something about leaseholds and how one can't have rust heaps parked in the garage, because then people will think the house is full of socialists, which is Kent's way of saying bloody idiots, Elsa understands. And then Alf shouts bloody idiot, which is his way of saying exactly that, because Alf is not big on complicating things. And then Alf comes stamping up the stairs again, wild-eyed and muttering.
The bastard got someone to tow the car away. Is your dad here?
Elsa nods. Alf storms up the stairs without a word, and a few moments later, Elsa and Dad are sitting in taxi, even though Dad doesn't want to at all.
I'm not sure I want to do this, says Dad. Someone has to bloody drive the damned Reno home, grunts Alf.
How do we find out where Kent sent it, then?
Asks Elsa, at the same time as Dad does his best not to look completely tentative.
I've been driving a damned taxi for 30 years, says Alf.
And?
Hisses Elsa. And so I bloody know how to find a Renault that's been towed away.
20 minutes